sense in everything in my show that we're all human, that we have an absolute responsibility to look after one another.
Roger Waters, founding member of Pink Floyd, and Sit Jolly, founder of the Media Education Foundation, which produced the film The Occupation of the American Mind, Israel's Public Relations War in the United States. Roger Waters is performing Friday and Saturday night at Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez is speaking about his new book, Reclaiming Gotham, tonight at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe, Arizona, at 7 p.m. Tomorrow night, Friday, in Austin, Texas, Juan is speaking at 5:30 p.m. at the Workers Defense Project. In the next weeks, he's heading to Newark, New Jersey, Kansas City, Missouri, and College Park, Maryland. I'll be speaking throughout Canada on the weekend at the end of September. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Amel Ahmed, and Nat Needham. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars, Carl Marxer, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug Meadows, Anna Ozbeck, Matt Ealy, and Kaya Cirilla. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 5 o'clock.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Speak for Peace, Thursday, September 21st at the HI Portland Hawthorne Hostel in Portland. Speak for Peace is a workshop that aims to develop the skills necessary to have constructive conversations when confronted with polarizing topics while recognizing and gracefully engaging with cultural differences. Again, that's Speak for Peace, Thursday, September 21st at 6 p.m. at the HI Portland Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts beginning Friday, September 15th, at Colonial Heights Presbyterian Church in Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts will be featuring live folk music every third Friday of the month, beginning September 15th through May. Again, that's Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts every third Friday of the month, beginning Friday, September 15th, at Colonial Heights Presbyterian Church, 2828 Southeast Stevens in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in breaking news, North Korea launched another missile today, along with a barrage of rhetoric against Japan and the U.S.
There was also a positive launch in the public health field. Dr. Tom Frieden, who recently stepped down from the Centers for Disease Control, announced a massive worldwide initiative against cardiovascular disease.
And tomorrow, the Cassini spacecraft, launched 20 years ago from Cape Canaveral, having traveled nearly a billion miles, will crash into the planet Saturn.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 14th, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. The National Weather Service is predicting up to a half inch of rainfall in the Portland area next week. They say the wet weather will likely arrive late Sunday, and we can expect widespread showers Monday and Tuesday. This will be the first serious rainfall in the city after three dry months. Earlier this summer, Portland went 57 days without rain, the longest dry streak in the city's history. The precipitation will be a welcome sight as more than 20 wildfires are burning across the state, including the Eagle Creek Fire in the Columbia River Gorge and the 185,000-acre Chetco Bar Fire in southern Oregon.
Today, KBOO Evening News brings you the fourth in a series of five episodes, The Hollywood Murders, A Day in May. In this episode, we review the event from a national perspective. Boston is Boston strong, but what has Portland become? How do we resolve what happened here in the absence of national leadership?
The Hollywood Murders, A Day in May. Episode 4, The National Spotlight. This is the fourth episode in a five-part series on the Hollywood Metro Station murders that took place on May 26th. In this episode, we'll try to find the national perspective. Why has Congress failed to recognize this event? What's been the effect of this event on the national image of Portland? Boston became Boston Strong, but how has Portland been seen? Beyond that, is racism somehow winning in a conflict with democratic pluralism? Here's Dr. Shweta Murthy on how the national media handled the incident. Her comment is all the more interesting in light of what took place in Charlottesville on August 12th.
What I found interesting about the way the Portland Max murders were narrated and portrayed in what I saw was how mainstream media chooses to isolate an incident in a particular geography and say, this can only happen there. It won't ever happen to us where we live, right? So the Max murders ended up being a unique ramification of the white supremacy history in Oregon, but it was portrayed as white supremacy doesn't happen anywhere else, right? Or that hate incidents or hate violence don't impact people of color, LGBTQ people, disabled people, immigrants and refugees anywhere else, when really only, you know, a couple of months around that was the killing of the Indian engineer in Kansas by a white supremacist.
Dr. Blazak made this comment about the comparison with Boston.
I think Boston has a little bit more of a history of dealing with all its moving parts than Portland does, because we're in a certain state of denial. I mean, if you think about the busing issues in Boston, and, you know, they really sort of powered through it, we're just in this kind of bubble, and people use this term all the time, this bubble of denial.
What about the treatment of people who commit this type of crime? According to Zakir Khan, the mental health issue can actually distract us.
I mean, I often see when a situation happens in Portland, one of the very first questions that Sergeant Pete Simpson, who's the public information officer for PPB, is asked is, did the person have a mental health issue? That question is never the first question asked when a Muslim person is arrested for a suspected crime. And so, is it that we only care about the mental health of white suspects, or do we care about the mental health of everybody in the state when a situation happens? That's a question that I think really needs to be answered by a lot of people higher up, and especially a question that we should start asking the media. Why don't you ask that question fairly of both sides?
Is there anyone who still believes that putting people in prison really solves anything? We still do that, of course, and no one seems to have any viable alternative. But what price do we pay for this solution? Randy Blazak talking about the connection between hate crime and prison life. Randy, it looks like a lot of people, including Jeremy Christian, get much of their education on hate in prison. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a big part of it. Even the way he stabbed those men in the neck was a prison tactic. That's something you learn. You jab people in the vein of the neck very quickly, repeatedly. That is a prison tactic if there ever was one. And one of the things, and this is another big issue, is radicalization in prisons. That we see, this is a big issue in Oregon. We see people who come to prison, and let's say they're caught on a Measure 11, because we have mandatory minimum sentencing here, that you can go to prison on a very low-level offense. It doesn't matter if it's your first offense or not. And you go to prison, and you're suddenly all by yourself, and there are Latino gangs and black gangs and other gangs, and you're looking at a pretty hard existence. And then a white supremacist gang comes up and says, hey, we'll protect you, but you got to do what we tell you to do. You go into that prison not affected by hate, and you come out covered in swastikas. So we just had this murder on August 10th of last year of this young African-American, Larnell Bruce, who was killed by a member of European Kindred. European Kindred runs a lot of the prisons in Oregon. They're the leading white supremacist prison gang, but today's prisoner is tomorrow's neighbor. I mean, those people all come out at some point, unless they die in prison, like Ken Mieske did. And they come out as full-fledged members of that group, and sometimes they have marching orders to carry on, their sort of racial mission outside the prison. So it's a real problem in Oregon.
Micah Fletcher pointed out that there's a connection between hate crime and drug dealing. When he calls out EK, he's talking about European Kindred.
The meth in Gresham that's moving down here, a lot of that's coming from EK. Like, these are not groups of people that are to be ignored. They need to be dealt with. Typically, white supremacist gangs deal in a lot of drugs. That's how they make a lot of their money. White supremacist prison gangs.
There's been a shift in the national discussion of racism, for sure. Here's Blazak again.
It's a frightening thing because we've moved the political discourse in this country to the right extremely. So the people who were sort of mainstream conservatives are now starting to become towards the left, and the people who are on the left are just a bunch of commies. I mean, that's the way the language is going. And if we keep going that way, then all of a sudden democracy becomes kind of an obstacle to those people getting what they want. So I think the people that are, the anti-fascist on a certain level have a real reason to want to be out in front of this, because there is this movement, and if we don't wrestle our democracy back, it could keep going farther and farther to the right, where at some point, the fact that John McCain is now framed as a liberal in D.C. is evidence of how far things have moved to the right.
Tomorrow, in a final episode, we'll ask the question, where do we go from here? How do we leave this? How do we write the history of what happened that day? Will May 26th, 2017 be seen as a turning point in the history of this city, or will it be just another mile marker on a long trail that began with the abuse of Native people and a misguided constitution and leads to a seeming series of hateful racial encounters? Where will this end? What have we learned from what happened that day? You've just heard the 4-series. Listen in tomorrow for the final episode, Where Do We Go From Here? You can listen to the whole series on our website, kboo.fm, and call or email us with your comments. Harvard University named trans woman Chelsea Manning a visiting fellow at the Kennedy School of Government. Manning, previously known as Bradley Manning, was released from prison in May. She'd been convicted in 2013 of espionage, theft, and computer fraud, and was serving a 35-year prison sentence until former President Barack Obama commuted it. Former CIA Director Michael Morrill announced his resignation as a senior fellow at Harvard after the university made the announcement. Morrill said he couldn't be part of an organization that honors a convicted felon and leaker of classified data. There was a storm of other criticism across the media. Manning had little to say on her new job on her social media accounts. She'll be joining former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer and campaign manager Corey Lewandowski as fellows in the 2017-2018 Harvard school year.
Dr. Tom Frieden stepped down recently after 7 years as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But instead of retiring, Frieden announced Tuesday that he will spearhead Resolve, an initiative targeted at saving 100 million lives over 30 years and preventing global epidemics. The New York-based effort will partner with governments and public health organizations around the world to reduce cardiovascular deaths and improve global epidemic preparedness. Frieden said the group will target cardiovascular disease, which is the number one cause of death globally. The disease kills nearly 18 million people each year. A group of philanthropists have pledged $225 million over 5 years. It includes the Bloomberg Philanthropies, the Zuckerberg Initiative, and the Gates Foundation, marking the first time those three major philanthropic players have collaborated in funding such a project. Frieden said the majority of the funding will go toward scaling up simple, inexpensive methods for countries to fight preventable cardiovascular disease, which can be linked to fatal heart diseases and strokes.
And now we go to an interview with Ernesto Falcon, an attorney and legislative counsel with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a leading citizen advocacy organization concerned with the law of the Internet.
The following is an interview with Ernesto Falcon, an attorney and legislative counsel for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is one of the leading citizen advocacy groups specializing in the law of the Internet. I'm Spencer Graves, a journalist with 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This interview was recorded Thursday, July 12, 2017. Mr. Falcon, without referring people to your website, EFF.org, could you please tell our listeners what you would like the public to do about the current Federal Communication Commission's Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on Restoring Internet Freedom, which is the freedom of major telecommunications companies like Comcast and AT&T to censor our Internet usage?
We're kind of approaching it in a number of ways. We're trying to activate the public so that they make their voice heard. We're filing our own, the attorneys at EFF are filing our own legal brief in terms of the issues and the impacts on the policy decisions that are being made and whether those are fit within the contours of the law.
Yep.
And we're trying to activate as many kind of technologists and folks who who are involved in the actual building and running of the Internet to weigh in with the regulator, because there are a different set of experts that are necessary to talk. So those are all the things we're doing, kind of like in a real quick summary. The hope would be that, the small businesses, the small internet service providers, and just the general activism around this space will make it clear the politics on this is very much one-sided. Chairman Pai wouldn't proceed, and if he does proceed, then it's a different posture at that point. Then we have to fight, we're probably going to have to fight it out in the courts, at the end of the day.
Do you have any specific suggestions regarding possible contents of official comments?
No one has to be an attorney to file comments to the FCC. All the FCC really needs is, why are the rules important to them as they stand today? So, like, the rules of non-discrimination, no blocking, no throttling, and neutrality generally. Why is that important today? What is the impact on them if those rules were removed? What's the harm that would occur? And then general piece of what the FCC should do, which is, I would suspect, stay the course. Don't change the underlying, a legally enforceable regime of net neutrality. Don't abandon that in hopes of the major ISPs kind of behaving nicely.
I've heard that if comments are filed in a certain way, the FCC is required to pay more attention to them.
Yeah, in the sense of the format would be, it needs to be concrete, concretely, kind of going over the way I just talked about it. You're explaining, I'm a local business or a local, organization or what have you. You're impacted by the law, and the change in the law would have the following, adverse consequences to me to do what I do, whether it's commercial product or some sort of other, like, organization or mobilization tools or kind of whatever they do. It depends on the Internet and depends on the openness of the Internet to be successful. So that's the stuff that gets attention, because the FCC has to respond to the concerns in its order by explaining how, it's in the public's interest to do what they're doing. And so like that, there's that, and then the you know, the bulk of the major numbers of comments are, you know, come from average citizens who just want a free and open internet and are just, and make it very clear in a, you know, one, two sentences. Don't mess the rules, leave them the way they are under Title II. I support neutrality, right? So those, the chairman has already indicated he will give less attention to, which is unfortunate. I think that's really kind of a disservice for, in terms of his job as a public servant. But, you know, that's what they're doing, and at the end of the day, this is a matter of the administrative agency and how it's supposed to, you know, work with the public. We're based in Kansas City, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the most fundamentally important thing for you guys in the state of Kansas is the senator that's your representative in Congress, Senator Moran. You know, he's a Republican that understands the importance of the internet openness, but he's also sympathetic to the ISP. So he just needs to hear a lot from people in the state of Kansas saying, you know, I like net neutrality and the rules that exist today. Please don't change it. As my senator, what are you doing to protect my interests? I've long worked with his office in the past, and I think he's someone who really understands the importance of innovation and openness and kind of internet freedom on a very different level than I think many other politicians do.
And, okay, great.
You know, my hope would be everyone locally, you know, kind of activates and makes those calls so that you have two senators and a member of the House that are pretty critical because, you know, they have a lot more of a say. The Missouri delegation also is just as important, I think, on this one. But in terms of the Senator Moran in Kansas, the reason why he's kind of unique is also he's also a lead senator on telecommunications policy. He sits on the Committee of Direct Oversight over the Federal Communications Commission, so he has a lot more of a direct say. People need to take it to the next step, which is plan to meet your elected officials, your two senators and member of the House, you know, in the coming week, and be very active, because it's only through mobilization that we're going to win this.
The Texas-based company that owns the Motel 6 chain, G6 Hospitality, has acknowledged that some of its employees at Motel 6 locations in Arizona regularly passed to the government information that led to its hotel guests being detained and deported. The company contended that these actions were taken without the knowledge of the management. The revelation of this practice by a Phoenix newspaper drew sharp rebukes from human rights groups and the American Civil Liberties Union, along with calls to boycott Motel 6, one of the largest hotel chains in the country. Immigration lawyers representing people who were detained while they were staying at Motel 6 locations and were later deported said that they had evidence showing that the practice was widespread and not limited to one state. A spokeswoman for ICE in Phoenix stated that ICE does not disclose or discuss information on sources of its enforcement leads, and said the agency does not pay any bounty or reward for such information.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Seminole Tribe of Florida is operating four shelters for members impacted by Hurricane Irma. As of Wednesday, there was a boil water notice in place due to a water main break. At least four reservation communities were without electricity as of Wednesday. Generators are being used to assist hospitals. The tribe is working with the Federal Emergency Management Agency as well as other agencies on recovery efforts. Door-to-door assessments were also expected to begin Wednesday. The Miccosukee Tribe of Florida has about 6 inches of standing water on roads. Cell phone service and utilities were out Wednesday. A senior center is providing food to tribal members and first responders. In Alabama, the Porch Banda Creek Indians declared a state of emergency, while tribes in Mississippi and the Carolinas are monitoring the progress of the storm. The owners of four liquor stores in White Clay, Nebraska, recently appealed the loss of their liquor licenses to the state Supreme Court. As Jim Kent reports, the hearing primarily approached the case as a technical legal issue rather than focusing on human rights.
Native American activists and their supporters spent 20 years trying to close down liquor stores in White Clay. The stores sold some 4 million cans of beer annually, most to residents of the nearby Pine Ridge Reservation, where liquor is banned. Success was achieved in May of this year when the Nebraska Liquor Control Commission refused to renew the store's licenses, citing a lack of adequate law enforcement in the small community. Store owners appealed that decision and were granted a hearing in the state's Supreme Court. Nebraska State Senator Patty Panzing Brooks is an attorney and supported the effort to close the liquor stores. She says the attorney for the stores referenced previous similar cases and brought up the question of legal jurisdiction.
Technical legal arguments that don't have to do with the devastation of the Native people. But again, with any kind of situation like this, law enforcement is one of the triggers.
Panzing Brooks adds the Nebraska Liquor Control Commission does have a requirement for adequate law enforcement in areas where they grant liquor licenses. Key to the court's decision will be clarifying whether the commission has the right to revoke or renew liquor licenses. A decision by the Nebraska Supreme Court in the White Clay case is expected to take up to 2 months. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs passed 3 bills this week involving economic development, veterans housing, and federal recognition for 6 Virginia tribes. The economic development legislation would clarify that 5 tribes in Oregon may purchase, sell, and lease land without further congressional approval. The bill for Native veterans would help with recruitment of VA case managers and create a set-aside rental assistance. The 3rd bill extends federal recognition status for 6 Virginia tribes. Leaders of the Navajo Nation remember former U.S. New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici as a friend to the tribe. The Navajo President's Office and the Tribal Council acknowledged Domenici after learning of his death this week. President Russell Begay says he helped with early programs like the Office of Navajo Economic Opportunity and added the 6-term senator was an advocate in bringing companies to Navajo land. The Republican senator passed away Wednesday in Albuquerque at the age of 85 after complications from surgery. The American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association has recognized tribal destinations and leaders in the tourism industry with its annual awards. Honors include the Talking Stick Resort in Arizona, owned by the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community, as the best tribal destination. People from across the country gathered in Green Bay, Wisconsin this week for the group's annual convention. Awards were handed out Wednesday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Quantic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribal-relations. Support by Northern Arizona University, a university committed to serving Native American students, offering opportunity in every direction, in Flagstaff, at community colleges around the state, and online. Learn more at nau.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
President Trump visited hurricane-scarred Florida today, where he met with state officials and visited areas recovering from Irma. The president landed in Fort Myers with the First Lady, Melania Trump, and met with a federal emergency management officials and Florida officials, including Senator Marco Rubio, Governor Rick Scott, and Pam Bondi, the state attorney, to speak about recovery operations for Hurricane Irma. Trump traveled throughout the damaged areas while Vice President Mike Pence traveled to Florida separately and passed out food alongside Trump and the First Lady. Mr. Trump emphasized the size of the recent hurricanes and the path of destruction that they wrought. He says, quote, "We had 2 massive hurricanes, the like of which I guess our country has never seen. One was the biggest ever in water and the other one was the biggest ever in wind," end quote. President Trump had previously visited the areas ravaged by Harvey and observed recovery efforts there.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth live interview with Ellen Daring from Portland, Entheogenic Research Society. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a Hip-Hop Perspective. Tonight's weather will dip down into the low 60s, and tomorrow we'll have a high of around 90 degrees. East of the Cascades, expect a nighttime low in the upper 50s, followed by a high tomorrow in the upper 80s. Today in history. On this day in the year 2015 was the first observation of gravitational waves. They were in line with Albert Einstein's predictions of general relativity. These waves were so minute that even Einstein doubted that they could ever be physically observed. The quote of the day is from Andrew Marvel. No creature loves an empty space. Their bodies measure out their place.
And now a look back in labor history for today.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day Illinois Governor Frank Loudon hoped to meet with striking streetcarmen in an effort to end their strike. Transit workers in Springfield, the state's capital, had been off the job since July 25th. But the strike had gained so much support that Springfield had now erupted into a full-blown general strike. According to the Sangamon County Historical Society, thousands of union members shut down mines, railroads, bakeries, restaurants, laundries, and construction sites following the violent crackdown of a pro-labor march by state police and militia. The march had been scheduled for September 9th. The union hoped to show support for the striking streetcarmen after a number of clashes between strikers and state militia. After they were denied a permit, many of the 50 or so unions decided to march anyway and were attacked. Some were shot. More than 40 suffered bayonet-inflicted injuries. By the 11th, most everyone in Springfield had walked off the job. Striking women shoe factory workers stopped a streetcar, pulling the scab drivers off by force. By the end of the week, as many as 12,000 members of 34 unions in the city were on strike. When telephone operators walked off the job, they paralyzed communications of the scab streetcar drivers and the state National Guardsmen. The streetcar strikers refused to meet with the governor until troops were withdrawn from the city. The governor insisted disloyal, pro-German forces were at fault for the labor troubles. By the 16th, the streetcarmen agreed to negotiate and the general strike was called off. But the company refused to meet striker demands for recognition and higher wages, or even take them back.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
It's 5:31. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Donald Trump loves it when crowds at his raucous right-wing rallies stand and chant in red-faced fury, "Build that wall! Build that wall!" So he keeps fanning their fire by repeatedly promising to wall off Mexico with a multi-billion dollar, quote, "big, beautiful barrier on the border." "We must have the wall," he tweeted in late August, promising again that, quote, "Mexico will pay for it." The problem with his bombastic promises, however, is that they turn out to be duds. Even Trump knows that building that wall is nothing but PR trumpery. In a phone call to President Peña Nieto, he admitted that Mexico actually was not going to pay a single peso for the offensive border partition, but he begged his cross-border counterpart to stop saying so publicly, for Mexico's adamant refusal to pay was exposing Trump the dealmaker as a weakling. Still, he loudly threatened again on August 21st to close down our government if Congress doesn't pony up billions to fund his pet project. But just 4 days later, reality intervened when a mass migration poured across the U.S. border. Not a migration of Mexicans, but of floodwaters from the Gulf of Mexico. Hurricane Harvey's biblical level of destruction not only swamped cities and communities all along the Texas-Louisiana coastline, but it has also swamped Congress with a tsunami of demands from GOP state officials for as much as $180 billion in federal relief, not counting Hurricane Irma. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, Trump and his gang of anti-big government congressional zealots were about to cut nearly $1 billion from the federal disaster aid budget when Harvey hit the coast. Now, they're scrambling to add multiple billions of dollars to that budget just to rebuild what Harvey destroyed. Where to get the money? Start by zeroing out every dime that would be frittered away on Donald's folly.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Around 7:55 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, tomorrow on Friday, September the 15th, NASA will watch its 20-year-old $4 billion-plus spacecraft plunge into Saturn. The agency has no other choice to make the space probe Cassini crash into Saturn. The fuel is nearly depleted, and the mission for Cassini has already stretched well beyond its original lifespan. Keeping it going also has risks for contaminating one of Saturn's moons, like Enceladus, an ice world that may have ingredients for life, or Titan, which is a dynamic moon where it rains methane. The microbes from Earth that may still be on Cassini can easily hurt the ecosystem of both moons. So the spacecraft will end its life by literally going where no human-made object has gone before, into Saturn's atmosphere. Cassini has made so many discoveries that have changed our understanding for Saturn and its rings.
It learned about whole new moons around the gas giant, discovered lakes of methane on Titan, jets of water on Enceladus, and it made extremely detailed observations of the planet's rings, which are believed to be of similar debris to the stuff that formed the solar system. On September 11th, a final pass-by of the moon Titan put Cassini on a final course that will lead to a collision with the ringed planet. The ending is bittersweet. Earl Mays, the project manager of the mission, calls the pass a kiss goodbye. And it certainly is one, because there is no way to stop the spacecraft from crashing now. The mission's scientists all remember their journey of studying Saturn with Cassini, especially with their families. Linda Spilker, who was a Cassini project scientist, says, quote, "Our families have gotten to know each other. In some cases, our children have grown up together. And now, in the final 2 weeks, we're sharing the end of this incredible mission," end quote. On its way in, Cassini will conduct its final mission. As it breaches Saturn's atmosphere, Cassini will take a look at the composition of that atmosphere, sending us its findings before breaking apart and melting in its grand finale.
It seems that the Cold War is heating up. Russia has begun some of its largest war games along its western border since the 1980s. The exercises that it's conducting with its Eastern European ally, Belarus, are creating intense anxiety in NATO. Russia's covert annexation of Crimea in 2014, which was masked by military exercises, suggests to some that the current exercise may be a Trojan horse to hide other military action. The scenario that most concerns the military planners is that the thousands of Russian troops moving into Belarus for exercises will never go home. Belarus is a former Soviet satellite that is often called Europe's last dictatorship. Meanwhile, neutral Sweden has launched its biggest war games in two decades. The Swedish exercise named Aurora is a simulated attack from the east on the Baltic island of Gotland, near the Swedish mainland. Around 1,500 troops from the United States, France, Norway, and other NATO allies are joining with Sweden in the exercise.
In breaking news, North Korea fired another missile less than 2 weeks after the suspected hydrogen bomb test, according to sources in South Korea. South Korean military officials reportedly said that the missile was fired from an airfield near Pyongyang, North Korea's capital, and headed eastward. Military officials also said that the missile likely reached an altitude of 770 kilometers and flew for 3,700 kilometers. Emergency alerts in Japan were issued around 7:06 a.m. this morning. Japanese officials also said that the missile fell into the Pacific Ocean about 2,000 kilometers east of Hokkaido, the country's second largest island. A North Korean state agency threatened earlier to use nuclear weapons to, quote, sink Japan and reduce the United States to, quote, ashes and darkness for supporting the latest UN Security Council resolution and sanctions over its latest nuclear test, Reuters reported. The Korea-Asia-Pacific Peace Committee, which is North Korea's official propaganda program, said, quote, "The four islands of the archipelago should be sunken into the sea by the nuclear bomb. Japan is no longer needed to exist near us," end quote.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn, Grace Ann Smith, and Isabel Cochran. Our engineer is Ben Shiregi. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand, and I'd like to extend a thank you to Janka Soderberg. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Hani and Lynn kick off our fall membership drive by offering listeners the gift of on-air Astro Tarot readings. At 9, it's Veterans Voice Radio with Northwest Veterans for Peace dealing with the after effects of war. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Making Contact looks at community-focused economic models, cooperative housing, and the Economy Coalition. Then Ibram X. Kendi presents The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. KBOO is your independent source for news and entertainment, and we want you to become a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Oh, is this lady here?
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
It's time for In-Depth Radio. We bring you tonight an interview with Helen Daring. And Helen is the organizer, or an organizer, of Portland Entheogenic Exploration and Research Society. But you have a more abbreviated name for it, Helen. Tell us that.
We are now calling ourselves Piers Portland Psychedelic Society because there are psychedelic societies forming around the world. And so we want to be part of that network.
Good. We get that change. And what is PEERS?
PEERS was founded a little more than 3 years ago, and its purpose is to destigmatize and legitimize the use of psychedelics for, they call it psycho-spiritual, but for spiritual purposes, therapeutic purposes. People are using them for depression, anxiety, PTSD, addiction, and so forth. There's been a real renaissance in the science of that, and so we just want to increase awareness.
Helen, tell us about yourself. How did you get into this? What are your qualifications for talking about this?
Well, I had a friend invite me to do some ayahuasca. I was deeply curious about it. I've been doing that regularly for about 4 years now. It has profoundly changed my life. It got me out of a lifetime of depression and suicidality. PTSD, I didn't realize the extent to which PTSD had been affecting me. I also have engaged in some underground MDMA-assisted PTSD therapy that has also profoundly, profoundly changed my life. That's actually in clinic. The FDA has just approved. I don't quite know the legal aspects of it. It's not quite legal, but the FDA has approved it as a therapy to fast track for PTSD because of its remarkable success.
You mentioned ayahuasca. Not everyone knows what that means. What do you mean when you say that?
Ayahuasca is a tea. It's a brew from the Amazon jungle that's been used for thousands of years down there in a very traditional ceremonial way. So a lot of Westerners, it's gotten very fashionable lately. A lot of Westerners travel down there. It's a extremely powerful hallucinogenic, but it's also known for its qualities to it works with a lot of people on addiction issues, like I said before, depression, anxiety, just incredible self-awareness and insights, and more than anything, I think connection and unity with oneness and each other and ourselves.
Helen, isn't it part of, and perhaps psilocybin is too, aren't they part of a religious experience in those cultures or not?
Yes, they are. It's very commonplace there. I know people who have gone and done ayahuasca in Peru while the family in the other room is sitting and watching TV and they're having their ayahuasca experience in the kitchen. I mean, it's very commonplace. It's very normalized there. People don't even bat an eye at it. Here, you know, it's a much bigger deal for us. It's very life-changing.
You mean it's part of everyday life? It's not part of a religious regime of some type?
It's part of their spirituality. We shy away from terms like religious because it's very triggering for people here. And a lot of people have gone into these experiences being atheist and come out with different worldviews. We still kind of tend to shy away from the word religion or God, but really unity, consciousness, a connection with oneness, with universality, of just sort of a losing, the dissolution of the self as the individual and dissolution into all that is. And it's a really lovely break from day-to-day human life to get to do that, and very medicinal.
I find that some things written about addiction say it's from like a disease of loneliness, and how you said that a lot of times these experiences make people feel very unified with the world around them, and that I've heard people say that perhaps it's worth looking into.
Absolutely. Not just ayahuasca, but mushrooms, even LSD. The actual founder of AA originally wanted to incorporate LSD into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because of how successful it is for helping people resolve addiction.
And what does 920 mean, and why is that a big deal in the psychedelic community?
So 920 is kind of like the new 420. It was a term that was begun by the 920 Coalition, and it sort of took on all over the world. So on 920 around the world, different psychedelic societies are having events. So here in Portland, we are having a 920 Portland psilocybin mushroom day at the Analog Cafe, and it's on 920. It's on September 20th, this coming Wednesday. And we're gonna have a mushroom growing demonstration with edible mushrooms, but to show you how you can grow your own mushrooms, and then we'll be raffling off that kit. And we had a very successful event in April on microdosing, which is taking very small, non-psychoactive amounts of different psychedelics, whether it's mushrooms or acid, and that has really helped a lot of people with also depression, anxiety, addiction, things like that. So we're going to do a little bit of a follow-up on that, have people check in, tell us what their experiences have been. And then we're going to have a presentation by the Oregon Psilocybin Society. And they are actually working to put an initiative on the ballot for 2020 to legalize the supervised therapeutic use of psilocybin in Oregon. So it's very exciting, and we're very happy to be supporting them and bringing their message to the state.
You're going to show participants in this how to grow their own mushrooms, is that right?
Their own edible mushrooms, that's right.
Are there any legal issues in that?
Not with culinary mushrooms, no. I mean, technically, you can buy spores off the internet and for use of culturing on slides, but we're going to just be showing people a little bit about mushrooms, and medicinal mushrooms and culinary mushrooms have very much in common.
So. I see. So you're not focusing specifically on psilocybin in that presentation. You'll be talking about mushroom growing in general.
Yes, that's right. We won't be doing anything illegal at the event.
All right.
Now, what are some of the things going on locally and nationally with psilocybin these days that people should be aware of? You did kind of cover some of that.
I covered some of it, but there's some studies going on. Like there's some clinical trials going on at Johns Hopkins University of psilocybin for helping patients with terminal illness. It's an extremely anxiety-provoking state to be in when you're dealing with a terminal illness. So they're having incredible success using psilocybin, and there's actually a documentary out about it, to help these people with where they are and find greater purpose in their life and in their experience.
Do you know if the Veterans Administration has expressed any interest in this? There's a lot. You mentioned PTSD.
Yes.
We have cases of that very close to here.
The veterans have been incorporated into the studies on MDMA, which is also known as ecstasy or Molly. It's a popular drug at raves and festivals, but it's also a very powerful therapeutic aid. So there have been studies using that in a therapeutic setting with veterans with incredible success. We actually have one here in Portland who went through that and feels cured of his PTSD. So we're going to be doing an event on that in the near future.
You have you've made reference to, in some of the writings on your website, to changing the law. You have a legislative initiative. Is that right?
Yes, that's the Oregon Psilocybin Society, and they'll actually be coming to KBOO on the 18th and doing an interview, but they'll also be at our 920 event. So they're going to be the feature speakers at our event. And that's to put an initiative. We need 88,000 signatures, so we'll begin collecting those next year, actually, to regulate psilocybin in a therapeutic setting. So it'll be a licensed building, certified providers. There'll be preliminary sessions, the actual session with the psilocybin, and then integration sessions. It'll be following the models that have been used in studies.
Do you mind if I ask, how has microdosing helped you?
Microdosing is amazing. It's really great because it's opening up the medicinal use of these medicines to people who just don't really want to take on a big, huge psychedelic experience. They can still benefit from these substances for, like I said, depression and anxiety. For me, I've noticed it can really perk you up without making you high, so you can get more energy. So microdosing with LSD, for instance, yeah. Distracted. Oh, sorry, here comes Tom. but we have just heard amazing stories. And the nice thing is that you don't have to trip. You don't have to feel high. Most people report feeling a little more energized, a little more creative. What the MRI studies of psychedelics have shown is that it's activating more areas of the brain, and it's connecting the right and left hemispheres better. So even a microdose, I think, in theory, can probably do that, and people can benefit from a more activated brain.
Right, but you said it helped you personally.
It's helped me personally in terms of more energy and more focus, because yeah. I think like a lot of people, I have digital ADD these days, so it helps me with my focus and concentration when I'm working.
Right. And what other mental illnesses, or does it affect physical conditions as well?
Yes. A lot of people report benefits from, especially with headaches, with low dosing of psilocybin mushrooms. So migraines, cluster headaches, people with chronic pain. Sometimes we'll even say it either helps the pain or it helps them cope with the pain better and feel less depressed, because chronic pain really can leave people feeling very depressed, which just compounds the pain. So it kind of lifts them out of that and just makes it a lot more endurable and, yeah, better coping.
Do you think this would be useful in end-of-life situations and hostels and places like that?
It's definitely being studied for that. Psilocybin and MDMA, for sure. I don't know if anything else is, Tom.
From my understanding, right now it is just psilocybin and MDMA. And right now, all the research is actually coming back positive. You have the Roland Griffiths study. You had Charles Grobe at UCLA. And you also had the NYU cancer anxiety with Estelon Walkoff, I believe her name is, had a really great testimonial. She had, an untreatable, I forget what it was. I think it was cancer, but don't quote me on that one. And she felt that using the psilocybin actually helped her to come to terms with that. It destroyed the depression that she was getting from it. And a lot of people are reporting also like better relationships with their spouses, because they are going through something so terrible. And it's been bringing people together, and they're working together to get through it now, which I think is always a positive.
Absolutely.
Tell us who you are.
Oh, hi. my name is Tom. I work with Helen and a few other people at Pierce.
What's your last name?
Hetzis.
Tom Hetzis. And what's your background with respect to this drug?
My background with respect to this medicine. Is that I have also used it for both the deep dives to kind of the more psychological trips to kind of just roll around the muck of your own mind and figure out what's going on. It's for me, it's been a very useful tool, and I know I'm not the only one. With microdosing, I would say that Helen said it best as far as the energy, the focus, and also the digital ADD, I believe you called it, getting a little bit past that and really being able to sit down and get this kind of work done, because it is a lot. And it's that beautiful, I guess, I don't know, flow of it that the mushrooms give you the energy to help promote them more and get them out to the world.
It looks like we're coming down to like the last 4 to 3 minutes, which can pass pretty quickly. And I just wanted to give you guys a chance to tell us any other events that peers have planned coming up, and to give you a chance to tell us what is coming up on 920 again.
So 920 again is Portland Psilocybin Mushroom Day, and that's at Analog Cafe at 7 p.m. So we have a bunch of events for that. Tickets are actually selling out pretty quick. So if you definitely want to go, I strongly urge you to get your ticket online at peers.space. And then on 9/23, which is the following Saturday, we are connecting with all the, not all, but a lot of the psychedelic societies around the world. And we're having a live stream event with Dennis McKenna and Rick Doblin of MAPS on DMT. And Tom, do you want to tell us a little bit about Dennis McKenna and why this is important?
Dennis McKenna is the brother of the late Terrence McKenna, and has been studying mushrooms. He's an what's the actual title?
Ethnomycologist,
I believe.
We had that problem. Let me interrupt here briefly.
Sure.
The word that we see is entheogenic.
Yes.
Oh.
Not ethno.
Oh, right? Well, entheogenic is just a term used when you employ a psychedelic for spiritual purposes.
Okay.
I tend to use entheogenic as the verb and psychedelic as the noun. But I'm like, there's me and I think no one else on the planet that does that. So.
In the original name of the group, the Portland Entheogenic Exploration and Research Society, that was the word that caught my attention.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's fine. Really what it comes down to, because time is limited, is that Rick Doblin and Dennis McKenna are two of the most brilliant minds in the psychedelic renaissance, and it would behoove everybody to listen to what they have to say.
Yeah, Rick Doblin's behind all the MDMA studies that are happening, so he's a real missionary in this
yeah.
work. And that's happening this Saturday at 3:30 p.m. at the Tabor Space, and we're going to be live streaming.
Not this Saturday.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, 9:20. 23, next Saturday. Thank you. At the Tabor Space. And the reason it's at that odd hour is because we're going to be connecting with psychedelic societies around the world, and we'll be able to see them on screen. They're going to see us, and it'll be really cool.
Where's the Analog Cafe?
Hawthorne, between Hawthorne Boulevard down, I think, by 8th and 9th, yeah, around there.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's two stories. Yeah.
All right. I think we better wrap up now. It's nice to meet you guys.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in.
Okay. Y'all have a great night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The time is 6 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Rose City Native Radio.